human hemoglobin molecule by a barely detectable amount, something like a half dozen atoms out of 10,000. The orangutan hemoglobin is somewhat more different, a dozen or 20 atoms out of 10,000. And then as you go down to horse and pig, we don't know yet, but it's a much bigger difference. To fish, still a bigger difference, but some similarities. And to a worm, Euracus, local beach worm here, there you find very little resemblance. From this, we can conclude that the gene for hemoglobin has been essentially the same for a long time, millions of years, long before the time when human beings and gorillas and orangutans became separate evolutionary lines. Well, pretty soon, I think, from studies of this sort, we shall know much more about the nature of human beings and other animals than we know now. And I think we'll know more about human beings, about the thinking power of human beings. There was a great mutation, favorable mutation, that occurred, it is estimated, 700,000 years ago, when the brain, the power, the gene that determines the size of the brain, mutated in such a way that the brain increased in size greatly, doubled in size between the precursor of man and man. Man had then become what we would call man, with great powers of thinking 700,000 years ago. These new powers, powers of thought, memory, imagination, and soon of communication as he learned to talk to his fellow human beings, have been of the greatest importance in the evolution of civilization. I don't know yet just what the nature of the change in the molecule of deoxyribonucleic acid, the gene, was that was responsible for this astounding step in the process, the molecular process of evolution of civilization. We don't, in fact, know very much about thinking in relation to molecules. The brain is, of course, made up of molecules. We are surprisingly ignorant of their chemical nature. We have cephalin, sphingomyelin, and a few others that have been studied and are characteristic of the brain and nerve tissue. Something is known about their structure. Something is known about the detailed structure of nerve fibers and of the process of conduction along nerves, but very little about thinking or memory. You know, there are two kinds of memory. One is ephemeral memory, which is also consciousness, and the other is long-term memory. I think there is little doubt that ephemeral memory is electrical in nature, involves an electrical pattern in the brain. It lasts something like 10 minutes. Permanent memory is material in nature, a pattern, a structural pattern of protein molecules and other molecules that has been laid down in the brain. The evidence, well, there's much evidence about ephemeral memory. For example, people who get hit a blow in the head that makes them unconscious often have forgotten, can't remember afterward things that happened in the preceding 10 minutes, say. Their memories for that period had not yet been permanently laid down, were only electrical and destroyed by the blow. People who have Korsakoff's disease, Korsakoff's syndrome, can only remember things about 10 minutes. This is a sort of protein starvation that accompanies extreme alcoholism. They are no longer synthesizing proteins, and they can't produce a material pattern, a new material pattern in the brain. They can remember things for 10 minutes, roughly 10 minutes. A man with Korsakoff syndrome can go downtown and do some business, buy something at the store, and come back if he carries a card with him that he can look at, which tells him every few minutes what he is supposed to be doing and where he's to go and that sort of thing. Well, I'm very much interested in the matter of what is going on in the brain. What are the molecules doing, and what are the electrical waves doing? What is the nature of the interaction between the electrical pattern that is involved in these electrical oscillations involved in consciousness and ephemeral memory, and the structural pattern that constitutes permanent memory? 3 months ago, I had nearly finished a paper, which I thought was extremely interesting, to me anyway, on a molecular theory of general anesthesia. Well, this is related. General anesthesia, that you know, involving taking ether or something like that, you become unconscious. General anesthesia is something that is related to the process of thinking, of encephalonic activity, and the interaction of the brain with molecules of diethyl ether or some other anesthetic agent. I haven't been able to get back to work on that, but I hope that I'll get that manuscript finished and published before long, and that in the course of years, scientists will learn, as I'm sure they will, but I hope I'll be one of them, learn something more about molecules in relation to thinking. Well, this was really very important, that the brain doubled in size 700,000 years ago, and that man learned, had increased ability to think, and in particular to pass information on to other people. What this did was, this mutation permitted the inheritance of acquired characteristics. For the first time, you know, rats who have their tails cut off have baby rats that grow tails, and no matter how long you continue cutting the tails off the rats before they have progeny, the tailless characteristic is not passed on. It arises occasionally by mutation, but independently of whether the rat has had his tail cut off or not, or the dog, a cocker spaniel or something. But we learned how to carry on this process of inheritance of acquired characteristics through communication. Somebody, some smart fellow a long time ago, learned how to use, to make a bow and arrow. And he was able, he didn't have to wait for the mutation for making bows and arrows to arise by accident in his germplasm, perhaps waiting a million years for such a complicated mutation. He was able to tell his friends and his children how to make bows and arrows. This is what has led to civilization. It was the gene that produced the increase in the size of the brain that permitted us to make this extraordinary step above that, beyond the abilities of any other animal, to pass acquired information, acquired characteristics onto our progeny. Now, something has happened as a result of this. A man or a woman or a child in the world today is not an organism in the sense that a rabbit is, or a lion, or a whale. He is something different. He is a part of a greater organism, the whole of mankind, into which he is bound by the means of communication, telegraph wires, and of transportation to jet planes and so on, telephones, newspapers, the means of communication in the way that the cells of an individual rabbit are bound together by the nerve fibers and the hormonal messengers that course through the bloodstream. We have to recognize now that this step in evolution has been taken for mankind. It has made this great organism the master of the earth, but this great organism, mankind, is still infantile, immature, somewhat feeble-minded, schizophrenic. Its left hand fights against its right instead of cooperating with it and working for the good of the whole. We have now to take the next step in the evolution of civilization, of humanity. We must achieve the mutation that will bring sanity to this great organism, the organism that is humankind. What is the nature of the mutation that is needed? Well, there might occur a mutation in the genes of the pool of human germplasm. Such a genetic mutation, ESP, for example, some sort of extrasensory perception might do the job, but I think we don't have time for this process to be effective because evolution by mutation of genes is very slow, one mutation in 3 million years per gene. We may hope that the mutation that will occur in the nature of this great organism will be a mutation in the means of communication among human beings that will transfer to the organism some of the desirable and admirable attributes that are already possessed by the units of which it is composed, individual human beings. These units are sanity and morality. I'll illustrate by giving some examples. You know, I think advertising is one of the most immoral activities in the world today. For the sake of profit, harmful substances are sold to people, unsuspecting people. We have trouble getting laws passed that will protect the citizen. Often these harmful products are pushed by misleading advertising. Our hormonal face cream rejuvenates the skin, $15 per jar, despite the cancerogenic substances. It's known that these steroids, sex hormones, can be cancerogenic. But of course, worst of all are the cigarettes. I'm not going to take much time about cigarettes, although cigarettes, I said in a lecture I gave at the Institute last year, are the principal cause of shortening of life expectancy by Americans. If we were to get complete control of cancer, Americans would live 2 years and 8 months longer. If we were to stop smoking cigarettes completely, Americans on the average would live 4 years longer. The Americans who smoke cigarettes would live about 8 years longer. Smoking cigarettes at the rate of one pack a day ages you so that at the age of 50 or 55, your physiological age is 8 years greater than that of non-smokers. Those who smoke 2 packs a day are by that time aged 16 years. Their physiological age is 16 years older, and they die 16 years earlier than non-smokers. Non-smokers, of course, aren't very harmed very much. They have to smell the smoke that the smokers produce, but it's not, a few days decrease in life expectancy, perhaps, not much more. Well, I think that, about $6 billion a year is spent by Americans on cigarettes and about $1 billion on advertising. I was shocked last year when I was giving the messenger lectures at Cornell that the Cornell, all over the campus, there were big posters, take part in the contest. And the Cornell Daily Sun carried a big advertisement to, hey gang, just a reminder to buy Camel Winston Salem cigarettes and save the empty wrappers. Your house or dorm can be the winner if you turn in the largest number of wrappers. Get that satisfying flavor, and lung cancer too. Win the contest. Which house on the campus will have the shortest life expectancy? When will the United States, like Great Britain, put on a campaign to keep young people from smoking? This has been going on in Britain now for 6 years. Well, nations are immoral too. National governments, all of them. Aristotle asked, can a moral man represent his nation? And he answered, no, because nations are immoral. A powerful nation attacks a weaker one if it thinks it can benefit itself thereby. Militarism is immoral. Patriotism, confusing the young about a very important matter, is incompatible with true morality, this extreme national patriotism. One sort of immorality that we've come to accept is that associated with military secrecy. I don't need to give you examples. You read about them all the time in the papers. There's a young man, Herman Kahn of the RAND Corporation, who is going around the country giving lectures, propagandizing for increase in the military budget. He makes some very, he advocates building bomb shelters and other acts of this sort. He said, talking about when he's asked a question that relates to something that he knows about but that is secret, he says, you don't have to lie very much, but you do have to look people in the eye and say something that is just not true. That is the difference in morality between the government and the non-government. Well, I think that we may be happy. We may be happy that nations are going to be forced now to be moral and to give up the great immorality of war. The existence of bombs, of weapons, stockpiles in the world that can destroy the whole world, so that if there were a war, the United States would be completely destroyed, practically every American killed. I can't predict what would happen. Would 5 million or 10 million or 25 million Americans remain alive, and a similar number, approximately equal number of Russians, depends upon how vigorously the war is fought. We have enough weapons, and they have, to kill everybody in these countries and most people in the rest of the world too. And yet, there's plenty of activity by people who want to continue the Cold War and speed up the Cold War, and some of them obviously are interested in the Cold War profits. There's no doubt about that. A short while ago, I saw in the New York Times a big article, U.S. arms makers are pouring capital into West Germany. The experience of the First World War and the Second World War hasn't been enough. Morality has to win out in the world now. Survival now means survival of the whole human organism. It depends upon whether or not we can work for the common good. The old evolutionary method, survival of the fittest, is no longer significant. Perhaps it will be a little later when we come into contact with other planets, with intelligent life, but so far as the world, the Earth, is concerned, it is no longer significant. We need to make use of a new ethical principle, a new golden rule. Do unto others 20% better than you would have them do unto you, in order to make up for subjective error. Of course, the golden rule that the diplomats have used from time immemorial is do unto others 20% worse than you would have them do unto you, in the hope that you can get away with it. You can always confuse the public about it anyway. I think that this new golden rule is being used in the negotiations that have been carried on for nearly 2 years now in Geneva toward the formulation of a bomb test agreement. I think that this is the most important activity in the world today, making this first of a series of agreements, international agreements, that in the course of time will lead to peace, permanent peace, to disarmament, total and universal disarmament, with the best possible systems of control and inspection. Ambassadors Wadsworth, Tsarapkin, and Wright have, day after day, for nearly 2 years, negotiated with one another with no mutual recriminations or vituperations, but in a sensible and straightforward way. Occasionally, a harsh word or two, just to prove to the governments back home that they were doing their job, I think. They like one another. Ambassador Wadsworth, I'm sorry, in one way to say, is, of course, no longer there. He is our ambassador at the United Nations. But perhaps we'll benefit by that. I think he's pretty good, really very good. And Stella, I don't know. I think that the ethical principles that human beings believe to be fine will be accepted by the nations of the world that are going to be forced to accept them, and that this great organism that constitutes the whole of humanity will be a moral, and ethical and sane organism accepting the principles of behavior that guide and are accepted by individual human beings. I believe that we can then, as the culmination of the great process of evolution, move together into the world of the future, a world of peace and morality and ever increasing happiness. Thank you.